Paul Thomas Miller and Marco Paolini, the Academy presents you both a Technical Achievement Award for Silhouette.
I've seen paint artists that paint 100 strokes a second. It's just instantaneously. There's no delay after a stroke. It's like literally airbrushing, right? There cannot be a delay between those strokes.
I think initially we have the original document from like 2003 where it was spec'd out as roto paint and compositing. So it was kind of funny because we needed to pull that document out at a certain point when we wanted to expand into compositing. And it's just kind of fun to see now how we had that plan way back when, and it just took a little time to get there.
Every time we think about adding a new paint feature that's kind of deep, it's exciting, but it's also a little scary just to go in there and, is this going to slow it down? That's always my biggest nightmare.
Doing shots, doing visual effects, you're going to redo things over and over and over. And even doing software, we're constantly changing. You can't get upset about that kind of thing.
Yeah, we had a facility who was, I'm not going to say complaining, but they were concerned that the rendering in Nuke was a 16th of a pixel off when it was in Silhouette, and that mattered.
So welcome to another episode of the VFX Artist Podcast. We have Paul Miller, engineer at BorisFX, and Marco Paolini, also at BorisFX, both working on Silhouette. So we're going to talk about the history of the software, which is vitally important, obviously, as part of the roto prep pipeline. So, do you want to introduce yourselves?
I'm Marco Paolini. I'm the product designer and product manager of Silhouette.
Cool.
Paul Miller, lead engineer on Silhouette, since we released the first version in 2004, I think.
Have you both been with the product from the beginning, or did you join? Some of you joined later.
We've been. We're like the original team. Yeah, I think it was back in 2004. We had a other company, Digital Film Tools. And at the time, I was also part of Digital Filmworks, and Paul was part of another company, Profound Effects. And we got together because, in the course of our work at Digital Filmworks, where I was a visual effects artist at the time, there was really kind of a need in the market for a good roto paint program. And the roto paint programs that had been around were no longer really around and supported. And we just felt like it was a good time to resurrect it.
Absolutely. So did it start as an in-house product, or were you immediately going as a commercial product to sell to vendors?
It was a commercial product from the start. And what made the product was, Paul's expertise with Elastic Reality, and really had a great product there that did morphing and was also used for roto as well. We were able to build on that expertise from his, technical expertise. And then on our side, we kind of had the artistic, visual effects background. And I think that the match was really, really good, on top of over the years, all the input that we've gotten from artists around the world.
Really cool. So yeah, Elastic Reality. This has actually come up a lot of in our episodes where we've gone back in time. I interviewed Sean Cunningham as well, talking about early days of Digital Domain, and obviously vitally important because all those big morph effects were pretty much done in Elastic Reality. I think even that Michael Jackson video.
That was PDI.
Was that a rival
software? Specific Data Images. They had just, that was their in-house tool, and that was about a year before Elastic Reality came out.
So Elastic Reality, you worked there as an employee, as an engineer?
Yes, at a company at the time was called ASDG. We came out with Elastic Reality in 1993. That was my first software that I wrote for Silicon Graphics workstations. And then because it was so successful, the following year we renamed the company to Elastic Reality. And then a year after that, we were bought by Avid Technology.
And so what let sparked the idea of, you know, going off on your own, starting your own business? Because it's obviously something a lot of people think about and most don't.
Yeah, I think Marco and I, it's interesting, we're both at Avid around the same time. This had been about 95, 96. And I think Marco was the first one to leave, I think, right? You went off to the Post Group?
I went off to Digital Filmworks. And
Digital Filmworks.
Yeah. And then Paul, you went off to Profound Effects after that, right?
Yeah. I worked on Elastic Reality for a couple more years at Avid. Was the lead engineer on their titler, the 3D titler project there that was called Marquee. Then I left. Moved back to Wisconsin. Joined forces with my old boss from Elastic Reality, and we created Profound Effects, making plugins for After Effects and Avid. So while at Avid, I designed their plugin architecture, AVX. So there was a big demand in the market. It was the first plugin architecture for the Media Composer editing system. So Marco actually reached out to me when they were at Digital Filmworks, because they were developing their own in-house tools for compositing and keying and things like that, and they wanted to turn them into products that they could sell. And so since I had done the plugin architecture and had just started my own company doing plugins, I think that's how we reconnected as well. Yeah. I started doing plugins for Marco and Digital Film Tools, doing my own plugins for Profound Effects. And then eventually we just decided that maybe we should write a rotoscoping and a paint system at the same time. It was always planned to do, I think the original idea was to do a compositor. There weren't that many around. It was back in the days of Shake and very early Nuke. So we thought maybe we'd do a compositor, but we'd start with that bread and butter, the thing that everybody needed was this rotoscoping.
I think initially we have the original document from like 2003 where it was spec'd out as RotoPaint and compositing. So it was kind of funny because we needed to pull that document out at a certain point when we wanted to expand into compositing. And it's just kind of fun to see now how we had that plan way back when, and it just took a little time to get there. But I think the fact that we did plugins first allowed us to kind of build all the little bits and bobs that were needed. And of course, Roto and Paint were, you know, for us, the kind of the main components, and we already had all the other plugins. And so I think Paul wasn't, Silhouette from the very beginning, even though it was just Roto and Paint, was the architecture was node-based, wasn't it?
Yeah, we designed it internally as a node-based system, keeping in mind that we had all these plugins being worked on at Digital Film Tools, and we knew that we were going to want to add more compositing features. So internally, it started out, and it has been all the whole time, a node-based system. And at first, we had a limited set of nodes. The first one was just Roto, and then the following year, we added Paint. And then there was, I think, Akir, and then eventually Morph. And then version 6, we exposed all the rest of the nodes. We added a whole bunch of more nodes in and just exposed the tree and everything else.
Right. So the nodes were more like, I guess, the hypergraph in Maya, sort of hidden away, rather than someone like Nuke or Houdini, where the node graph is like front and center of your interface.
They were kind of there where it you couldn't rearrange them. There was kind of a set order where it was like the source, then Roto, then I think Paint, and then we had like an effects node that was kind of a combination of Roto and Paint, and then morphing, and then you could turn one node on or off, or you could have them all on, or you could view one and edit another. But there was no flexibility in how you place them, and you couldn't have multiple Rotos; you just one of each.
Yeah,
it was just a chain, but internally it was literally creating and destroying and reconnecting nodes. It's just you couldn't
directly manipulate them. That's interesting. Invisible nodes. I thought of nodes purely as a UI thing. I never really thought that nodes could kind of exist in the background of a software that isn't node based as a user.
Yeah, and I think once we decided to do the compositor, Paul wrote the actual tree viewer, what we called nodes, separately. So there was just a separate little program for, you know, connecting up, you know, the foreground, the background, that, you know, the obey mat input, so that was all done first. And I think,
and that was,
yeah,
know, that was mostly just to save time, so we could experiment with, you know, how we wanted the node interactions to work, so that you could, you know, how you would connect things and getting the behavior right, where you can, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but you can like, we call it, well, I call it internally, kiss detection. So if you put a node near another node, it'll connect up to it if you get it close enough. Little things like that. But that was mostly just to save time, avoiding the compiling and running cycle, you know, because Silhouette was pretty big by then. We got all that sorted out and working, and then integrated it. And that was really neat when we started, where you could actually create more than one node. That always worked internally. You could have two or three rotos. There was just no way to get at them.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool.
My question to Marco is, you came from an artist background. I was just going to ask how you ended up at Avid and then obviously starting a business as a software creator rather than as a supervisor or something.
Yeah, I actually worked in Hollywood as an editor, first as just a regular online editor, using, you know, traditional linear editing systems. And the facility that I was at ended up getting a media composer, as well as a parallax Matador paint system for doing graphics at the time. And I, you know, as part of the package, I got training for Avid. And when I went to the class, the instructor said, hey, you know, because I actually went, the class I went to was like a train the trainer course where they were training instructors. And they said, you know, if you ever wanted to do this, if you ever wanted to train people, you know, we have a need for that. And so at a certain point, I did it kind of on a freelance basis, going out to various facilities training. And then they offered me a job and I took it. And, you know, I did that for a couple of years, and I was a trainer to start with, which also then led into product design, because I knew the Matador paint system. I was actually a user. And so I was involved with product design for a brief period before I left Avid on the Illusion compositing system. We called it Avid Media Illusion.
Oh, wow.
You know, they had it for, a couple of years. You know, they were trying to kind of compete with Flame at the time, you know, where Flame was really fast, where there was, you know, quick interaction where you'd be working with the client over your shoulder. They were trying to compete in that area. Eventually, the product was discontinued. But from there, I ended up working with one of the Avid customers, which was Digital Filmworks, who had Matador, they had Illusion, they also had Shake. And that was my kind of introduction to feature film effects. But I had, you know, after working at Digital Filmworks for, maybe 4 years, we had a number of tools that we said, you know what, if we could get a programmer and start working with them, we think we have some tools that, you know, other people would like to use. And, that's when we hooked up with Paul and started getting the plugins going. We came out with our first set, which was Composite Suite. We had various composite-related plugins, and I think we came out, I want to say we came out with the Avid version first, and then After Effects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the light filter, the light effect, was the very first one that we did.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted to emulate optical filters, and so it was somewhat cinematography-based, where, you know, Paul's speaking of the light filter, which, you know, gobos, and it was quite an extensive filter from which a number of other filters were created.
It's pretty.
Yeah, sorry to jump in. I just wanted to point out, so Digital Filmworks, the owner, one of the owners of that company, was also one of the sort of like key customers of Elastic Reality back in the day. So it's just to show you how kind of incestuous the whole industry is. So in a sense that I've been working with one of the founders of Digital Filmworks, Peter Moyer, since like 1993, he was always providing input on Elastic Reality and other tools that at Elastic Reality that we had built. A lot of them used on early television digital effects. Just wanted to kind of shout out for him.
I just wanted to help some of the sort of younger listeners or viewers, just because a lot of things come up that might not really current in the industry, even if you're a working professional. So obviously linear editing is basically you've got tapes, you've got a tape deck on one side, and you've got a tape deck on the other side that records. If you want to do a dissolve, you have two tape decks on the input side and like a mixer, like a DJ would have to mix between them, and you'd record and you'd do it in order in a linear way, which was used for episodic TV. And the non-linear system at the firm is first film, where you're physically cutting the film, and then the digital tools like the Avid. And then I guess the other thing that came up was the software's Matador. So it was one of the earliest. I think there was there were like two or three paint tools at the time, right? Matador was one.
Matador was one of them, and I can't for the life of me remember what the other. There's there was in-house tools.
There's Liberty.
Like Chiron had that at a certain point, right?
Yeah, Liberty Paint.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting too that you mentioned yeah. That the people that you work with and somewhat incestuous. But my first job when I was linear editing, first I was a tape operator where I was just spooling up the tapes in the machine room and getting food for the editors and the clients. But I got my chance offline editing first one of the other bays, and I worked with Price Pethel, who ended up doing effects at Digital Domain on a number of films. But working with somebody like that, worked on a Diana Ross music video, who and he was obviously a number of years ahead of me, but being able to learn from guys that had it all figured out, doing effects in a super rudimentary way in a linear edit bay, where cutting mats were using a downshooter camera with a black and white something that was drawn or printed out to be able to cut the mats. But and Peter Moyer, who was a partner in Digital Film Tools and was one of the owners of Digital Filmworks, he did all the effects for the original Star Trek generation. Did a lot of the Michael Jackson videos, and he was the head of the post group, the digital division, where, Rob Legato was working at the time, just a number of people, and then they all split off and do various things. So, yeah, I think we've all been pretty lucky to kind of be in the right place at the right time and, having met certain people, and just some is just luck. You decided to take a job and you met incredible people that helped you along in your career.
Yeah, no, it's really important. I mean, I think it's the biggest thing is the relationships that you build in the industry. And it is a small industry. Even now, I mean, it was much smaller then and it's a lot bigger now, but it's not that big. Like, you will, especially as you get more senior, you will meet the same people throughout your career. It's undoubted. Like, the other people that are juniors with you right now, if you're a junior, or mids with you if you're a mid, or even senior if you're a senior, they're going to be around, and you're going to move to another company and they're still going to be around. You go to another country and they're still going to be another round. So you need to build those relationships, because as you yourselves have done, it can be vitally important.
Yeah, I think real quick, I'd like to point out something. You made the analogy, you're talking about nonlinear and linear editing. There's a parallel too, right? With filmmaking, right? We went from optical effects to digital effects, and the same process goes with the optical effects, right? You feed the film through, put an effect on it, or you might key another element over, and then you just do it again. You run through a new strip of film, and that's how it was all done until late 80s, right? Very early 90s, and then things started going digital, and it's actually really fascinating and pretty awesome just to be part of that switchover when things were being invented all the time for how to do this stuff. And like when I started working on Elastic Reality in 1993, I didn't know what an alpha channel was. I hadn't met those people yet. It was an established thing by then, but it was kind of interesting to be like, what's this alpha channel thing? And then, a year later, you've got this software that everyone's using. It's pretty neat to having lived through that. But on the flip side, I've been doing Roto now for almost 30 years. It's almost kind of sad in a way.
It's interesting that, I mean, but Rhodo is so fundamental, and I guess we're on the verge of something similar, right? A similar paradigm shift right now. And I know that we had trouble scheduling this interview because you guys were busy. So I was wondering what you've been up to.
We do so many things. You know, we just...
Point releases.
Yeah, point releases. We're working on a Silhouette 2022.5 release, which will come out shortly. And then we're off to our 2023 releases. But, you know, we're constantly taking user input, trying to improve the product. We, you know, it's always like a balance of like, you know, what we think we need to put into the product, to keep it viable, to, make it effective, make it better. And then what users are asking for as well, you know, because we have both large companies, that may have different needs than say, you know, the one man shop. So, you know, we're always trying to weigh those, but, you know, we're working individually, you know, on our product. And of course, Boris Effects is working on, you know, as many image processing type projects that you could think of, whether it's AI based, whether it's just traditional, you know, grain management. There's, you know, research and development happening in tons of different areas, because we, you know, we have not only... There's Silhouette, there's Mocha Pro, which also does Rhodo, and of course their Tracker, but there's Sapphire plugins, the Continuum plugins. And, you know, we always try and think of things that can be shared company-wide between products. And also now being part of a larger company that has these different products, we, as Silhouette, as a product, benefit from that as well. So if one team... like the Continuum team, who now uses kind of our Silhouette architecture behind the scenes that Paul wrote, if they make something new, we automatically get it if we want it. It just can show up natively. And Beauty Studio is an example of that for doing, you know, edge preserving blurs and beauty work on people's faces, you know, to lighting plugins, everything else. And that goes for Sapphire too, because we include the Sapphire plugins as well.
So how big is your team?
It's still predominantly me, and Marco. We have some contributors that are working on smaller pieces, like importer exporter type stuff. That's stuff that's shared around the company. But so far the core, like pretty much what you see in Silhouette is my code. Except like Marco said, for 2022, we added a whole bunch of stuff from like Sapphire, and we had a Particle Illusion, and those really expanded our, you know, our tool set quite a bit, in terms of just nodes. There's a lot more effects nodes and more compositing nodes and things like that.
So Paul, what's the, you know, we always talk about, you know, whether or not if you had four more programmers or five more programmers, you don't necessarily get five times more output. There's a certain benefit of one person controlling everything.
There is. We've looked at expanding the team for a long time, and every time it just seems like a daunting task to try to train somebody up on 15-year-old code base and things like that. But there are smaller, more low-hanging fruit type things that would be pretty straightforward. The Silhouette's pretty modular from an architecture point of view, and I designed it so that people can plug into it easily, and it can be expanded easily, and nodes can be built in three different ways. You can write Python to make it do a whole lot of stuff. So there's all that. But lately, going back to the feature set and how we talk to customers, it's really cool, because in our forums, you might get a couple of "Can I do this?" kind of things that are really easy, that, you know, I'll just be in the middle of a big feature and then like, well, yeah, I'll put that in. And then the next maintenance release comes out, it's just there. And then we've got some other, you know, bigger facilities that want like bigger features that can take weeks or, you know, a month or whatever. So it's a nice trade-off in terms of development time. But yeah, we would like to definitely expand the team. Silhouette's doing well, and we have like years worth of features just in the list. Part of part of our problem is deciding what's going to go into what release. We were planning on putting a bunch of this stuff in this 2022.5 release into the 2023, but we thought, well, we've got so much stuff. Let's just put it into 2022.5, mid-year release. We have so much stuff planned for 2023, like let's just split it up and, it's already done. So let's kick it in there. And
that's cool.
It's fun.
And I guess having it earlier, I mean, it obviously adds value to the customer, but it also gives them a chance to feedback on it if they want.
Yes.
Once it gets out to the artists, it does change, I guess, from what you imagine. People always do things you don't expect them to do with your software.
Yes, exactly. That's one of the reasons, for instance, why the keybinding, I always talk about this, like the keybinding system is a great decision way back in the day to just build it on top of the scripting engine. So we get a lot of requests for, can I make the software work like other software that I've used? And the answer is yes. There's no easy way to do it in the GUI. You can't just go in and like grab a button and assign it to, but you can go into the scripting system and literally change the way every single button works and what it does. That's really worked out pretty well for a lot of the bigger facilities that have integrated Silhouette completely into their pipeline. When they, they get a shot assigned to them from some database and it's all set up and everything ready to go, they don't even have to say, import media. That's really amazing. And we only barely know scratch the surface of what some of the companies are doing.
Well, and it's not just assigning like a simple feature to a keyboard shortcut. There's the concept of actions, which are scripts that can do very complex steps, multiple things in a row. Paul's got a set of actions that come with Silhouette, that kind of serve as examples. But very complex things can be done. Some facilities have done their own rendering system that pops up their own user interface that completely bypasses what Silhouette does.
It renders right to a database, an asset management system, for instance. As Marco said, a lot of even the features of Silhouette itself, like even a whole bunch of the Roto tools that we added in 2022 are written in Python that just show up in menus, but you can go in there and change the code or see how it works, and add your own stuff. It shows up on the same place. That's been really fun. I'd like to make it as extensible as possible.
So my question is, obviously, now you are talking about finally getting to do some of the compositing stuff. I think it's really interesting because obviously your big customers, Silhouette is pretty dominant in Roto departments and to some extent in prep departments, apart from where, and so whereas compositing, obviously Nuke is the big sort of rule in the roost and the one man shops, as you say, often After Effects. So, I can sort of see that you've got this advantage of there's an advantage of not being a competitor to Nuke in just doing Roto, but there's also something quite exciting in the air. Something I'm interested to see what another compositor would do and what might be the advantages and how that.
Initially we had requests from various, prep departments at larger facilities that were doing paint, Roto, a little bit of compositing and wanted to be able to do the entire shot in Silhouette and not have to go to Nuke. There's obviously different factors. Some of it's easy use, some of it's training, some of it's cost, for the seat. They don't want to tie up a Nuke license to do certain things, or a particular artist really only knows Silhouette. So we initially decided to do the compositor because of those requests. We're like, if we could just do some basic compositing, we can do a little of this, a little of that, we'd be happy. So initially that's why we did it. And of course we've added more and more to it. And the more we put in it, the more we get asked to add to it. Because now the requests are like, if you could do a little more of this 3D stuff, that'd be even better. So it, it, you know, once, well, now that we've gotten to a certain point, then we get the additional requests. But I think that's why we originally did it. We wanted to try and keep those departments and customers in silhouette if possible on those particular
what
shots.
What kind of shots are you talking about?
You know, removals, paint fixes, you know, procedural removes where you wouldn't want to have to paint every single frame. Maybe you paint a clean plate and then you use tracking and compositing to, you know, comp a whole block. You know, it's a lot of it first came from the paint department saying, because initially they were removing grain and they wanted to comp the grain after and, you know, paint on the degrained plate. And, you know, then it was like, well, we need multiple roto nodes and maybe we're going to use, you know, a couple transforms to track in a couple major spots, but then paint a little bit more here. So it was a more involved paint fix, you know, whatever the paint fix may be, whether it's, you know, removing a wire, removing, you know, fixing up, you know, a head replacement or whatever, you know, it.
We're seeing a lot of tattoo replacements,
yeah,
blood replacements, things like that.
Yeah,
I mean, those can get pretty, pretty comp heavy. I'm going to be honest, I've not actually used Silhouette. I've always used Nuke from early on, and at the beginning, I used Shake. Even for photo, which wasn't fun. I mean, and that obviously depends on the kind of facility you start at, whereas I think Silhouette is biggest in the big facilities.
Yeah, it's just extensively for paint,
yeah,
for paint work, just because the paint is so fat efficient.
And it's more, it's much, in performance-wise, you've got the advantage over Nuke when you are doing roto and paint, right? You're just simply playing it back faster.
Yeah, like the first, for instance, the roto, when you have lots and lots of shapes and you're using motion blur, I mean, the differences between multiple seconds in Nuke and milliseconds in roto for changing frames, I mean, it's that doesn't even compare. On the paint side, it really kind of depends on maybe how many strokes, you know, vector systems, when you start to get a lot, they can start to lag. You know, so we're not vector, we're raster, but we have some changeability and reproducibility and repurposing of strokes that can be replicated over multiple frames. You know, I think it's
integrated tracking.
Yeah, integrated tracking, integrated roto in, you know, into the paint, so you can be obeying the mat of the roto as you're painting. You know, that's all integrated together, so it works, you know, very nicely. And of course, this all works in stereo. So for the shops that do stereo, it's really important to have those tools. And those stereo tools came from a facility request saying, hey, we're doing a show. We need to be able to paint. We need to be able to roto, and we like to do X, Y, Z, and we need it by this date. And that's we ended up doing it. And I think at the time, I can't remember, Paul, if we were the first to have stereo in that area, but it was pretty close with whenever Nuke started doing it. I'm not quite sure about the timeline.
Yeah, I don't even know what Nuke's workflow is for stereo roto, but I thought we might have been the first, where you could roto either left or right eye, duplicate it to the other eye, and then simultaneously edit both splines on both eyes if you want, on a per point basis.
And then with paint, all of the transforms. Paint similarly.
Paint was right? The same thing.
Yeah, paint, you can paint on the left side, the right side, both sides at the same time.
You could transfer your paint from one eye to the other, and then it would take into account the interocular distance and combine that with the match move. And that was all in version 3. That was our big 3D stereo version.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it was 2D only. There's no 3D objects, but it was just the ability to stereoscopically do everything.
No, this is interesting. And obviously, I guess stereo is less common than it was a few years ago. But has there been any kind of advantage to building those tools in non-stereo projects?
Well, they came in very handy when companies started doing the stereo conversion too. No, but I think that's not quite what you're looking for. There are still definitely many shows that are shot in stereo, where they're still doing everything in stereo. One high profile one that I always think back to was Weta. They shot it at 120 frames a second.
The Hobbit.
Remember that in stereo? No, they did that in 48. This was the Ang Lee movie. Remember that, Marco?
I don't remember which one it was, but yeah,
they shot that at 120 stereo, and they had to do all the paint and roto work for that. I mean, astronomical amount of work. So they were, you know, they were asking for things to help with that. The shots were so long. We had to make a few tweaks to, you know, make that manageable.
You had to, apart from the fact that I think price point wise, rotoing a nuke maybe isn't the best thing to do anyway, but once you have those very long shots, that's where you would really also start to feel the pain of trying to use nuke.
Well, and now we have Silhouette's an OFX plugin, so it will run as a plugin within Nuke. Of course, we can pass our shapes back and forth to Nuke through an export process, but now you can launch Silhouette from inside Nuke, work on it, and then you've got, if you want to work in Nuke that way, you can still get into Silhouette, work on the shot, come back, and then you have the benefit of the Silhouette user interface, but the speed of the Silhouette rendering, and you're ensured that what you saw in Silhouette will match exactly to what you see in Nuke, where, you know, the shape export process, although is pretty established and it works pretty well, there's always that situation where a shape is doing something that it shouldn't be doing in a particular situation because of the differences between the products. You know, whether it's, you know, the interpolation method is slightly different, and in some cases it's, you know, it's, there's a, there can always be a case where it may not be right. You know, somebody will always find that.
Yeah, we had a facility who was, I'm not going to say complaining, but they were concerned that the rendering in Nuke was a 16th of a pixel off when it was in Silhouette. And that mattered. That mattered to them, that 16th of a pixel. And at that point, it's just, their renderer is just different. So I was amazed that we were actually got that close. But this is something that the plugin completely alleviates. You need that extra precision.
And is there a performance hit from running it as a plugin? Because I guess you've got to wait for Nuke to kick the media to Silhouette, or?
I don't know. I haven't seen one. I think it's still faster at the end of the day. There's minimal conversion going on. It is a standard OFX plugin, though. It's not a native NDK effect. So it probably could be made faster, but probably most of the overheads are going to be in Silhouette itself, not that.
And in the Silhouette plugin, whether it's in After Effects or in Nuke, it's the full product now. So you have a node-based compositor, Roto, Paint, all the associated nodes within those products. So it's kind of interesting that you can get node-based compositing within After Effects when it's layer-based. So you can have a completely separate node-based comp going on in AE separately.
I mean, that's very powerful that changes the game with After Effects a lot, because obviously Paint and Roto in After Effects is also a bit more tricky to control just because of the nature of it.
Yeah, like, you know, we really did set up the Paint system, for instance. You know, it is really designed as a classic, like, hand paint kind of system. And, you know, some of the artists that have done shots as from a hand paint perspective, right, where they hand paint every frame in the traditional manner, has been incredible. You know, they'll have thousands of strokes on every frame. It was designed to handle that, and it does it really well. But I'm continually impressed to see what, you know, you don't, a host's workflow might change your behavior. You know, if you know you're dealing with vector, you may do something different if everything's a vector paint stroke or something. Or if you know that you can't have more than you get to a certain threshold and it's just going to start slowing down and not be usable. That matters significantly to, you know, some of these artists. And the same is true for Roto.
I think it's interesting to see too, you know, we've seen some like sped up screen captures of an actual very, very complicated shot being done in silhouette with the paint. And it's amazing to see the process and how I remember when I was painting things, you know, you'd spend a certain amount of time in each frame, then you kind of play it back, try and fix problems. But these really complicated shots is, you know, these artists just beat those shots down until they look perfect. It, you know, first you're looking at it going, no way, it's going to look like crap. And they just keep going back and back and over the frames and until the lighting's exactly right. And it's just amazing to see what can be done in the hands of somebody who's got that skill. It's pretty amazing, I think.
Very cool. And I guess so far, talking about the paradigm, like a bit like the analog to digital, I mean, we've got some really impressive machine learning stuff. And of course, the Roto that you're getting from AI at the moment isn't up to the standard of human Roto, and the same with the paint cleanup. But it is getting better, and it's getting better fast. So I was wondering what your thoughts on that and what you're doing about it in Silhouette.
I guess I'll start by saying that, you know, it for us, we have made sure that we have what we feel are the best set of manual tools that can handle a person running in the forest with a shaking camera against changing, flickering backgrounds and leaves. And, you know, we've tried to build the tools to handle, you know, the ugliest and most difficult shots as far as Roto is concerned. So when we think, and I think consider AI, at least for me, I think there's, you know, the questions that we have to ask are, is a mat only okay for output? If it's not, can we create a shape with as few points as possible, with as few keyframes as possible, so that it can be edited later, especially in the areas where it's not right? Now, for some people, they're like, I don't care, mat's fine. Other companies or people need those shapes. I mean, if we assume that it's, let's assume it's perfect, nothing needs to be done to it. Well, either a mat or the shape, regardless of keyframes, you know, then that would be okay. I don't know that we'll ever get to perfect in all shots. But you know, if there's a way to accelerate the process to give you a great starting point that's editable, well, that's a different story. And, you know, that's where I think for us to be interested, that's what we need. And, you know, we've done some things for customers who are using AI to spit out a result, but then they need some good manual tools to fix the overall result over the course of a bunch of frames with a ton of keyframes. And I think in
a ton of points.
So in 2020, I think it was in 2022, we put in a multi-frame range feature that allowed you to attenuate the effect of your adjustment over, you know, a ramped area of keyframes, so that if your AI result drifted, say, consistently over 200 keyframes, you could kind of like slide that back in. But yeah, we've looked at it. You know, we'd like to have the magic result just like everybody else. But again, it's trying to figure out, you know, how much memory does it use? How fast is it? And is it editable into the result that you need it to be? So, you know, we're looking at a lot of those things, and, you know, we just need it to be right to be useful, because at a certain point, if you get a result very quickly and an automated result, say in an hour, but it takes you 4 hours, 5 hours to fix when you could have just did it in 3 hours manually. You know, it's just, it depends on when that starts to change, you know, that it becomes more important.
I think the editable feature, I think that is that the tough nut to crack, because that's what I found with every time I've experimented is it either works or it doesn't. And when it works, great. And when it doesn't, well, what do? I start again. I just go back to the way I was doing it before.
Yep.
But what I want is the starting point from AI that I can work on.
Yeah.
It also depends, you know, a lot on, there's different thresholds for what constitutes quality and good enough, right? And as I mentioned, there's some places where a 16th of a pixel to them is noticeable. And if your AI solution isn't, you know, up to that level where it's perfect, then you're redoing it anyway. This kind of takes me back probably 28 years to Elastic Reality. We added a feature where it was one of the first edge snapping implementations. So rather than dropping down Bezier points, you could just draw a line around something and then it would snap, you know, would do an edge detection while you do it and it would snap. Do you remember some products have that? We even have something like that in Silhouette. But it always bothered me because it didn't put points where the artist put points. It would, right? Over the years, like when you're doing roto, you know, you kind of develop a sense of where you put your points. And it's just automatic when you're laying out shapes and things, you know where to put the points. And then, you know, there's the temporal aspect of that. But a lot of these tools, even the automated, you know, the AI to point shape conversion type problem is gonna have that issue where it's not creating the points and the shapes where the artist would do it, and you'd have to end up having to go back and tweak them anyway. This has been a pervasive problem for like this whole time. Whereas I think it's all about your threshold for what's good enough. And one of the things I learned, I don't know, I think it might have even been Peter Moyer who told me this. I think one time I was working on some feature for some product and I said, I think this would be good enough. And he said, if it's just good enough, it's not good enough. And it always stuck with me. So we're making tools for artists where it's gotta be perfect, not just good enough. And I think AI is still in that, well into that realm of it might be good enough, but depends on what, you know, you're going after.
I think some of our customers are doing previs on kind of quick comps, you know, prior to a film's financing, as a method to quickly comp, you know, tons of shots, and having AI mats that are not great but can be generated somewhat automated, in those cases are good enough for them to say, okay, we know the effects kind of look like crap, but it's enough to kind of give you financers and studios enough to decide whether or not you're going to give us money to finance this project. So I think, you know, having a lower quality quick result, you know, for that type of work is, you know, great. You know, just like offline editing where you, you know, used to work at a much lower resolution. It was like good enough to see the cut and good enough to get approval and move forward. So I think these are all tools, and you know, we want to embrace them just as much as everybody else, but we also, you know, as Paul said, there's a certain level of quality we know our customers want. And if the majority of the time it's not producing a result that they're gonna use, then they probably won't use it. And like Paul mentioned, like the snapping tool that we have in Silhouette that came from Mocha. I never use it because of exactly what Paul just mentioned. I'd rather spend a little bit of time and get those points where I want them and not have a ton of points that are randomly placed that I then have to drag around and put them where I want. So I think for us, you know, like in the short term, you know, of course we want to make sure that our tracking is as good as possible, because that kind of assistance can produce those, you know, as having the tracking information as part of like a transformation layer and the keyframe for shapes on a separate transformation, that allows us to have the ultimate flexibility. So I think kind of the shorter term answer is to really get that tracking locked down as much as possible. And that's why, you know, in addition to the point tracker and Silhouette, we had our own planar tracker. We include Mocha Pro, both kind of in an integrated fashion, and but also as OFX bundled plugin with Silhouette. So you've got the best tracking available directly within Silhouette. So.
Yeah, and now we're starting to take advantage of their mesh-based tracking, which adds that extra nice layer of organic tracking. And we're still innovating in terms of just being able to move points around. Just as the number of points have gotten become larger, and the number of keyframes have gotten larger, and as Marco mentioned, the client that is producing their own AI-generated shapes, they need to edit in Silhouette. Now they've got a whole bunch of control points on every single frame, and how do you edit that? And that kind of forced us to think about the problem of how do you hand roto all that stuff, all that data, and we added a bunch of tools for doing that. Came up with a really neat roto combining the paint brushes, so you can do brush-based reshaping, which is really nice and organic and lets you kind of pull things around. And you combine that with multi-frame mode and the ability to do the multi-frame ranges, as Marco mentioned, with the attenuation, you can get a lot of really nice. Oh, and then we added the preview, so you can preview motion blur over time without rendering it. So all of those things combined give you a good sense of what, you know, what your shapes are doing over time. And then being able to very quickly edit them organically, it's keeping us on our toes, but it gives the artist those extra tools they need, to do those kinds of shots.
That's really cool. Kind of circling back to machine learning just quickly, I was wondering, is that something that, rather than trying to do the roto or do the shot, is it something you've thought of using to make some of your tools like the tracking better, or the snapping? Actually, I would imagine if you're training it by putting the points in the same place, you could train it to have better snapping when you try using snapping.
We've tossed a lot of those things around, and a lot of it comes down to development time and having enough people to do those kinds of things. I'm still focusing on stuff that, you know, a lot of our facilities are actually asking for. I know, you know, AI roto is a hot topic, but at the end of the day, we don't get a whole lot of requests for it because they're already kind of invested in the tools and know how to use them, and again have to get that level of precision we talked about. But Marco, what
I'm gonna
were you say?
We have a AI team that's, you know, working on various models to assist both tracking and roto, but you know, there's all the things that I mentioned, are going into, is it usable? Is it fast enough? Can it be deployed properly? We saw some great tests earlier from somebody we were working with, and on the face of it, it looked good, but it was like, it took forever and it used way too much memory and the edges were not good, you know, but in general, the motion looked pretty good, you know, but, you know, aside from the fact that, you know, hands disappeared here and there and, you know, heads, you know, were half size.
It looked great until you zoomed in.
It's like, okay, it, well, how do we like overcome these things? And it's like, you know, some of those things are,
no, you got
to
go in
multi-year
my hand
projects to try and solve. So, yeah. I mean, you know, as you mentioned, things are changing rapidly. It just depends on what's changing and how rapidly, you know.
I guess it's the YouTube creators and that are going to really lead the charge with this stuff, because they can get away with it good enough and possibly be at the forefront. And then, of course, as it gets better, they're going to be the ones that have been using it for 4 or 5 years, when maybe in 4 or 5 years it is good enough.
Yeah.
And as... Sorry, did that sound like... That didn't sound like awful news. I mean, I imagine that you're going to keep developing your products in the market that is there, in keeping up to date. Obviously, you've got your own AI research projects and you're moving into comp. And is that...
Yeah, we're going to keep continuing to do what our users want us to do, for sure. And if more of them, you know, they're smart. They know, right? They know that they've seen these tools. They know that they're not going to produce the results that they need. So, but when they do get to that point, they'll probably start asking for more of that integration, better integration, and then we'll do it.
I mean...
But yeah, right now we have these research projects going on and they're ongoing and it just.
I mean, to me, it's kind of like having a keyer in your product that just produces a bad result.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, so that's hard to get excited about. But if it's a keyer that produces a great result, then of course you want that. And our customers are focusing on churning out their shows that are going to Netflix, that are going to theatrical release, and you know,
in 8K.
Yeah, and it's I think the conversation we should have the conversation when, at which point, when and if AI produces as good as a result as for Roto as a human can on the majority of shots. And if we don't have a solution by then we probably won't be talking to you anyway. So
yeah. Oh, we'll be talking in a bar. But what
it'd be nice.
What,
but see, this is important though too, to realize, like, so when I started linear editing, and all those linear editing companies, they're gone, you know? And so the Avids and, you know, the Adobes came on the scene. I had a good friend of mine whose family did process photography. It was the Hansard family who did all the rear screen projection in Hollywood for years and years and years. And it was interesting because as I was starting at Digital Filmworks, they, you know, that's when the in the 90s, the digital really started to pick up, and they essentially, their business turned into nothing. Same thing with, you know, optical film labs and optical effects. So I think that we need to, you know, keep an eye on these things, because we don't want to be the linear editor, the process photography guys. You know, we want to keep iterating the product as we go, so that it's always usable, you know, for whatever is taking place. But we also see our customer shots and we're like, no way. You wouldn't even attempt to run it into just because the amount of motion in the background and you can't tell what's what and the motion blur, it's like, forget it. But like you said, certain static, very slow moving shots, you know, that like Adobe may show with some of their Sensei technology of, you know, somebody walking across and doing some color correction. Yeah, that may be great for a lot of customers doing corporate work, and they don't need that 16th of a pixel accuracy, and they don't care about kind of funky edges every once in a while. So yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, we don't want to come off as poo-pooing it. We know it's there. We know it's getting better, and we'd like anything that can make our software better and cut down on the amount of work. But again, it has to be good.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the other question is, what other technologies are exciting you in your field?
You know, we're doing research in grain management.
Exciting.
It's a big request. See, some of these things aren't exciting, but to our customers, they're like, this is kind of like It's like how some people feel about roto. It's like, it's not exciting, but it's one of those things that they have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And it's important for them to be able to extract it properly, to add it back in properly, with the least amount of problems. I don't know. I mean, I think for exciting stuff, I mean, we're always looking at, you know, how we can propagate our shapes automatically with, you know, again, as few keyframes and as few shape points as possible. And we have a number of, you know, areas of paint that, you know, we're investigating that we'd like to do as well.
Yeah, there's a lot left in paint. And that's a big, it's a big project, but that would be, that's exciting.
I mean, paint is hard. Yeah. I mean, I think people outside of the industry or even outside of 2D, you know, they're like, well, roto paint is junior, you're a junior, you do roto paint, then you move into comp. But that's not because paint is easier. It's because, I mean, there's a sense that there's a very definite right and wrong, which in comp isn't always true because it can be more subjective. But the reality is some very hard paint shots are just very hard and can be very senior. You know, there are people that are senior paint artists who are given the shot that no one else can do, and nothing can track, and you have to paint it frame by frame.
You've just described our friend Eddie at Weta. He does some amazing stuff, and he's within one of the best artist requesters of things over the years. It's always been very valuable ever since I was at Elastic Reality, having certain key users that are kind of vocal. They're not mad or they don't get upset with you, but they're just like, hey, can you do this? Can you do that? And you really want to please them. Certainly. And, you know, not even that, I mean, just from the artist perspective, but just thinking about some of the math required to make some of the paint work, this kind of keeps me up at night. When you're getting into the paint engine and Silhouette, I'd forgotten about this part of it, but you know, when you're because of the way match moving works, when you're painting, you're not always painting on a flat surface, right? When you project the paint onto another frame of motion, your brushes start to become oblong ellipsoids in space, right? Or every sample of a brush starts to become a non-rectangular region in it, and then it maps into all of the other math for like cloning and things like that. It's complicated, and every time we think about adding a new paint feature that's kind of deep, it's exciting, but it's also a little scary just to go in there. And is this going to slow it down? That's always my biggest nightmare. Is this going to make it slower?
If you're painting frame by frame, you need it fast because you need to be back and forth. Otherwise, it just boils. If you try painting frame by frame in Nuke and you don't really have that playback possibility, you know that it's just going to boil when you play it back. Try it procedurally. You would try and do something else, anything but paint if you can.
Yes. Yeah, and a Silhouette is getting baked in, right? Get baked in. It knows all the data, and you can use that to whatever you want to for later. But it's getting baked in, so you don't have that problem. But you have the problem of when I've seen paint artists that paint 100 strokes a second. It's just instantaneously. There's no delay after a stroke. It's like literally airbrushing, right? There cannot be a delay between those strokes, and that's been another major issue with just
and the resolution is getting bigger, and you've got HDR, and you've got
and you have to manage undo and all the database and everything, and it can't, there cannot be a lag, and now do it in stereo, right? Paint on both eyes at once. Now it's double the, and it can't lag. So that's one of the reasons why people enjoy Silhouette. It just does not slow down. It's always been a,
I mean, the beauty of the Silhouette paint is that, number one, because it's raster, as soon as you let up on your pen, it writes it out instantly. So there's never a buildup. But I think the simplicity of it is that when you're painting, it's recording everything you're doing, every stroke, every brush change. And once that those series of strokes are recorded, and that means like by time you pen up, you can then repurpose those. So essentially it's like having a macro being written constantly, so that once those strokes are there, you can then say, you know, these strokes, I'm going to track those over the rest of the frames, because all that work I did on frame one with good tracking, it's going to be good on all these other frames. And I think just that basic recording a macro all the time, kind of concept, and being able to repurpose that on other frames is what makes Silhouette's paint so versatile and fast on top of it.
The other thing is, this goes back to the original design too. We've had one of the requests from some customers was they wanted to start the paint, but they didn't have the final platelet yet. They hadn't gone through the degraining or the color correction. They wanted to pre-color correct it. So they would do the paint and then get a new plate in. And then there's a rebuild button. It'll go back and redo everything you did from the very beginning. On the new plate, and they've used that a lot. You know, it saves you so much time, so they don't have to wait on the final plate. You know,
because we're not just talking clone paints here. We're talking like painting color.
Yeah.
So it's good to remap that.
Yes.
To the,
because if you're picking off of the screen, if you're picking off the image, doing repairs or whatever, then it doesn't matter what the new plate is. It'll do the same thing you did. It'll sample the color. It'll do everything. Nothing's baked in, except for the actual gestures.
Yeah. That's really cool. And the other weird one that is always a pain, as everyone knows, is retimes. I mean, there's a whole Reddit page of VFX artists called F Retimes. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's quite big. And I imagine that is something that you guys have to also look at and handle.
By the time it gets to us, it's been retimed, usually.
Yeah.
This is exactly the kind of thing where probably some places would be, you know, we're retiming in Nuke and then we're going into Silhouette and doing everything else. Let's just skip that step of that retiming, right? But I don't know. Do we have a node that can do it?
We don't have a optical flow like retime. The Continuum product has like a version based on like, you know, older technology. It kind of needs to be updated, but it would be good to have like a really good retimer. I mean, I know with Digital Filmworks, we used to use retimer, and I'd set off the analysis like at night on an Onyx workstation and come back in the morning to have it done. And then of course like as with AI, you know, the result with, you know, optical flow retiming at that time would be all kinds. There'd be weird frames, you know, in the optical flow field when you get like overlapping motion, for instance.
Even now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of your paint work shots that are going into Silhouette for paint are coming to paint out optical flow.
Yeah. But that's what we ended up doing. We had to end up, you spent the night analyzing and rendering, and then the next day you'd be painting all the fixes and tearing and rips and, you know, whatnot that happened from it.
And, I guess an example when I'm thinking of retiming is, there's this production problem where a shot is retimed, it's double speed, but the edit isn't quite locked. Maybe it's quadruple speed. And so the question is, do I send it to paint and they paint the original frame, but then they're painting four times as many frames as they may need? Do I take the risk, have them paint 200 frames, but then if they change it, now I'm in trouble? My question is there a way in that situation where you could save the work if that retime changes?
So, no, because we don't have a retiming solution. But if we did, then the paint data could be interpolated because it's all vector internally. So yes, I think we haven't had that request, but when it does come time to integrate or to make paint work with retimed, with changing frame rates, it would just be a matter of resampling the paint, and I think that probably would work. But you'd have to rely, if you're expanding the paint range, it would just be, you know, linearly interpolating out the paint, filling in. especially doing motion blur on the paint strokes. But that this should that would, I think that would work. I think you're the first person to ever really ask.
It's a first on the VFX podcast.
I think you know, it's like we focus on things that we know we can do well, and time wise, we just don't have time to sit down and research retiming. But I don't. Yeah, like I said, I don't think we. I mean, if somebody had asked for it, we probably would have done something by now. But again,
I'm surprised. Yeah, I would have thought someone on any of the Fast and Furious movies or the Matrix movies.
A lot of the bigger facility, houses, they've got a pipeline, right? So they do all this this initial stuff, all any retiming or whatever they're going to do, and then it comes into Silhouette, and then it goes on to someplace else.
But they always have to make the call. They have to make the call. Do we just do the paint on the retime plate, or do we paint on the original plate? And there are obviously costs.
Yes.
Cost, risk, benefits on both answers. There isn't a correct one at the moment. That's one.
Right. For us, the future for paint, we'd like to kind of blur more the line between raster and vector. And what you can use your imagination as to what that would mean. But, I think flexibility, after the fact, however we can make that work, we'd like to make it a little bit more flexible, because I think the more that we can do that, we don't want somebody to say, well, the vector system would be better for my particular shot because of XYZ. We don't want somebody to say that. Of course, we could argue, well, it's going to be slow if you have too many strokes. So, but yeah, I think that's the future, is whatever. Reusability, being able to modify after the fact, which again is normally impossible with the raster based system. Maybe different things we can do with keyframing.
We did add a feature recently where you could sort of preview what your stroke would look like.
Yeah.
And then lay down a stroke or two. And then if you didn't like it, you could sort of undo that and change the settings and then just redo it. Things like that. But yeah, more dynamic support would be good. And the paint model supports it. So that's going back to the whole discussion of what's interesting. Like, that's an interesting problem. It's kind of funny because it's always, I love working on the architecture. I love making it extensible and putting new stuff into it. But it always comes back to roto and paint for me in terms of what's interesting. And we've talked about those are kind of boring things. There's something that you have to do. Nobody talks about them, but yet to sort of innovate and to make more people happy and save people artists time, there are some interesting problems to solve. And it is always kind of fascinating when we do come up with some way of improving them.
I think anyone that struggled with paint tools, even if they've used, whether they're a Silhouette user or not, is going to find it interesting. Because we all know the issues anyone in 2D. My other question is, what about non-realistic paint? So if someone was making a movie like from a Scanner Darkly or Bakshi's Lord of the Rings or something where they wanted to use rotoscoping and paint in an artistic way, maybe they wanted to make everything look like an oil painting and they wanted to get some artists to paint things by hand and make them look interesting. Do you have support for that, or would it be a case of exporting mats to a compositing application?
I mean, I would say, I think a little more work would need to be done, but currently we have the ability to fill shapes with color.
And outline them. And you can bring shapes into paint. That's for masking purposes.
Right, but you could do an overall brush, I guess, through the mat, but not automatically, other than unless you use like one of the cartoon filters, which is not
or painterly
probably what you want. But yeah, I think we'd need to do a little bit of work on maybe gradients within the shapes, probably gradient fills.
Yeah, take some of the stuff out of the depth node set.
Yeah. we have a depth node that's used for stereo, where there's a bunch of different gradient fill types, you know, to simulate depth.
People are making their own depth maps. Rotoing.
Yeah, that could somehow, because we've used the roto node in a couple different places. You know, the guts of the roto node is used in the morph node. It's used in the depth node. It's used in the power mat node. You know, various nodes that require shapes. You know, it could potentially even be a separate node that has more kind of traditional, you know, ink and paint type features for the shapes.
Yeah, we haven't really focused on that kind of special effect paint stuff, but we are getting more requests of that nature now that we're a plugin into After Effects, for instance. We're getting more we had somebody do a shot where they hand painted a bunch of like glowing effects on things, you know, like neon lightning coming off of moving objects and things, where they just went and hand painted that on every frame, just using like really glowy colors. And then they passed that paint, just the paint strokes, through another filter that added a nice bright glow effect on top, and then comped that back on. So there's ways to do stuff like that. Because you can have the paint node spit out just the stuff that you painted, just the strokes with an alpha, and then do things with that. But in terms of painterly, brushy type stuff, no, not yet.
And the other last kind of a task that comes to mind in terms of a shot that you might be interested, you might do in silhouette, is seamless transitions, stitching two different plates, a drone to a crane, so that you can keep a continuous move. Those shots are always very hard and challenging. Is that something that you for your feature set would be quite strong for? Or
you can do that now with the morph node, but in the classic way that even people were doing with Elastic Reality back in the 90s, it was used a lot for that, like documentary cuts, things like that. Seamless transitions between stuff. But it would be more traditional, you know, roto this, roto that, morph it across a couple of frames. We do have a project in the pipeline to make that a little easier to do with shots like that.
You can't use layout and cameras here, and
not at this time. No,
no.
It's been on the list for a long time. We've had several customers wanting to bring in geometry and do things like that, so we're aware of that need.
I'd like to ask each of you, if you wanted to, so in turn, I guess, in your role, if you, so start with Paul, if someone wants to start out and become an engineer and work for one of the software companies, what would your advice be to them?
I got into computers and things when back in the day when not everybody had a computer, right? So I was the kid that liked to take things apart and figure out how they worked from a very young age. And when I discovered computers, that just kind of just changed my world. And so I learned everything I wanted to myself, because, well, by the time I got to college, you know, they were still teaching like Pascal. I was already, you know, programming Amigas and C. So it's just, I was sort of like way ahead of the curve. And I think that voracious appetite to sort of like understand things from a, like how the gears work, how things work, was kind of invaluable for me personally. And I got to the point where I just wanted to write programs all the time. Like I wanted to just make stuff. And I think having that sort of that creative desire, whatever, to sort of create your own stuff, is probably the number one thing. Whenever I'm talking to, like, let's say a younger programmer, I'm like, do you program for fun? That's always my first question. Do you do it for you? And to me, that's interesting. If they, oh yeah, I'm learning some new language. I'm writing some of these tools. I'm doing this. I mean, that to me, that's interesting, rather than just the, you know, I'm a programmer for 9 to 5, right? For instance. I don't know if that's more of like a philosophy, like an attitude, right? I don't know if you can teach that. It's sort of an innate trait, right? That's what I would always look for. if aside from all that, whether you have that sort of innate desire to do that or not, I would say if someone wants to get into this industry, just, I think it really helps to understand, you want to learn what was going under the hood. I think that's always really fascinating. Like, to find out how things work under the hood, like learn how the GPU works, how memory works, right? How images are represented in memory. Well, obviously, there's the whole languages. I assume you're talking about from the programmer point of view, right? Like learning to be a programmer in the VFX industry. Just, I mean, there's so much as well. Different disciplines, you know. We're doing predominantly 2D type stuff, image processing, right? Then you have your 3D, all the math involved with that, VR, you know, the AI, even like more traditional programming of like, you know, asset management systems and databases. Just, you're just working with data and models and converting formats. I think I'm kind of rambling a bit, but I think learn Python. Python is it's the glue language of the whole of our industry. And I discovered it in 1995 and just fell in love with it. I try to do everything that I can in Python. If you know Python, you can probably get a job almost anywhere in the industry doing at least that. But certainly all the major VFX tools are written in C++. There's a lot of Python for the glue. And then just, you know, learn the various tools and plugin architectures. One of the kind of interesting ways that you could get into the VFX industry, or even just the special effects image processing industry, is learn OFX. You know, learn the Open VFX format and just write a filter. You know, and then download your favorite package and just see how your filter interoperates with other software. Silhouette, Nuke, I mean, all the big VFX packages support OFX plugins. Start with that. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but it's a stream of consciousness kind of thing.
I think you did. I think you answered it really. No, that I thought was good. And I guess, Marco, it's a little bit more complicated because I think you've done, your career path is more varied. In one sense, you've obviously been an artist, an editor, you've done compositing, you now lead a product. So my question is, what is your advice for people starting out, and what is your advice for people moving to different fields within the industry?
I think the best way, say for a student, is to pick and choose the proper internship potentially at a company that they would like to work. Because if you can get your foot in the door and you work hard, you're not an ass, you get along with people, they'll recognize that and there's a good chance you'll be hired. And I think you can't be afraid to start at the bottom. I mean, when I started, I went to film school and, you know, I had various skills, but I took that tape operator job working at night, you know, not making a whole lot of money. But it led to being able to learn their editing system and then eventually editing and then going out on shoots because they had a production arm. So don't be afraid to start at the bottom. But I think for visual effects, I still think getting in as a roto or paint artist, starting there can, you know, lead to being a compositor. If you're talented, and not everybody is, you can create a great reel and that reel will get you hired any day of the week, provided the facility has openings. But if you're only partially talented, but a really hard worker, and you can pick up technical skills like roto, that's a way in the door to being a compositor. You know, editing is so decentralized now. That's kind of a harder, I think, a harder nut to crack, other than, again, if you have a really good reel, you know, you at least have something, but it's always about knowing somebody. So that's why the internship is good. You know, for me, when I went to school, there was a group of us in our class that, you know, kept in contact. And when one would get a job on a particular show, they'd drag as many of us over that they could. And, you know, those relationships are indispensable. It's like, even for me getting, I never envisioned being in the software industry. It just so happened I showed up at a class and somebody made a comment and I'm like, okay. You know, I just had the good fortune of kind of switching before each industry died, you know, from one to another. You know, when I was in visual effects, you know, you could make quite a bit of money. And I'm sure there's people that still make quite a bit of money now, but I think the general artist rate is much lower than it used to be. You know, I used to work with clients and, you know, you could make more money doing that. But again, the most important thing, getting in the door, having a reel, if you can create one, and you know, those internships are super important. Not that everybody can get those if they're not in school, but, you know, learn the tools of whatever facility that you want to work at. And you know, there's roto jobs show up at ILM, at, you know, various facilities. They may be in a different country, so you have to be prepared to move these days. So yeah, don't be afraid to start at the bottom, work hard, make a good reel. And, you know, it's just like anything, it's very competitive.
And if you want to learn Silhouette, you can get a personal learning edition. Is there one or a limited?
If you're a student, you can get a license, a complimentary license. Otherwise, there's a 14-day trial, and that's about it. But the good thing is that all the Boris FX products are can be monthly subscriptions now with no long-term commitment. So you can rent it for a month, you know, and there's a lot of really good classes out there. There's, you know, various companies have classes that you get access to the software during the time that you're taking the class. So those are always good to be a part of. But yeah, just really learning the tool. Because, you know, whether it's Nuke, whether it's Silhouette, you want to be able to make sure that you don't have to think about how to use that tool. You know it in and out. You may not use it well, but at least you know how to use it. And I think that's the important part.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cool. And as we sort of come to a close, are there any sort of final thoughts you would like to, that I haven't asked you about that you really want to get in before we go as a kind of closing?
Just maybe going off of what Marco said just now, I would like to reiterate that I think being able to, especially, I'm assuming you're probably talking to younger generation of VFX.
Sometimes, I mean, our audience is varied. I mean, our audience is, I mean, when it started, Kofi was very much thinking, how do you encourage people that want to get into the industry? And we are keeping that alive. At the same time, we're aware that a lot of people who are quite senior are listening. And that's why we like to go deeper and get more detailed in and perhaps ask some more difficult questions that might be unclear to some of the those that are not quite in the industry yet. But,
okay.
But, you know,
I would say for like the, you know, is going back to the points that Marco made, certainly I think just being willing to put yourself out there. And, one of the favorite things that I learned from being a programmer and knowing other programmers is don't necessarily, if someone asks you, if you know something, it's okay to say no, but just say, I'll find out. And then go find out. I think that's probably the biggest piece of advice I can say. And I guess like I think it probably applies to any age. Just be willing to go find out, and it's okay if you don't know, but have that curiosity, as I mentioned earlier, to go find out and figure it out, that'll open many doors.
I guess I would close with saying that I think success in this industry is really dependent on just an incredible eye for detail, and you can't be afraid or can't be offended about redoing something because doing shots, doing visual effects, you're going to redo things over and over and over. And even doing software, you know, we're constantly changing. It's, you can't get upset about that kind of thing. So you know, be willing to change, go with the flow, and great eye for detail, because that's what will matter.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time this evening, or this day for you guys, I guess.